You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we still can't swear on the radio, but in some workplaces, cursing seems to be getting more common. We'll talk to a leading expert on curse words about how norms are changing. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked lower court rulings on Friday on the abortion drug mifepristone. Those rulings aim to overturn the FDA's approval of the abortion medication or at least more recent changes to FDA guidelines on the use of the drug. The Supreme Court's action means the drug remains widely available, but the case moves back to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to issue a ruling in the future. It all comes from a federal lawsuit in Texas where an anti-abortion group argued that the FDA improperly approved the medication back in 2000. The drug remains mostly illegal here in Wisconsin, given the state's near-total abortion ban that came back into effect after last year's Dobbs ruling. We're learning more about what the court rulings mean and where the legal battle could go from here, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this series of court decisions or the laws involving mifepristone? How do you feel about the U.S. Supreme Court, at least for now, maintaining access to that medication? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. David S. Cohen is a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. He's author of the book Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we have this action from the U.S. Supreme Court, but it doesn't seem to end this story for now. What did we actually see out of the U.S. Supreme Court on this?
So this case is in the very early stages, and basically what the trial court had done was say, even though it's early on in this case, we haven't had a full trial, I'm going to put the FDA approval of this drug on hold. And that happened 2.5 weeks ago. He was going to put the approval on hold while the trial played out. And so these were emergency appeals from that preliminary order. And the appeals court in Texas originally said, well, you can do that. You can put the approval on hold with respect to new changes with the drug. And the Supreme Court just put his entire decision on hold last week, our Friday night. They basically said, let this case play out, but we're going to keep this drug available and on the market and approved while this case plays out. So it's all preliminary. We still have to have this case go through the whole works now.
How normal or unusual is it for a judge at that point in a lawsuit like this to say, looking ahead, we're gonna take this off the market for now while this trial goes on? How common is that?
Everything about this case is very unusual, starting with the initial the request from the plaintiffs here. No federal court has ever said the FDA has improperly approved a drug without the FDA saying we also made a mistake. This is unprecedented. This claim from the plaintiffs has never happened before with any drug. And so to have a judge say preliminarily, I agree with you, and I agree with you before we've had a full trial on this, that we're really in completely uncharted waters here.
One other unusual thing that I got to admit, I didn't quite get how unusual it was at the outset, even having talked about this on the air some, is the issue of standing. And this could feel a little obscure, but so we've got a group, it incorporated itself in Amarillo, Texas, where this judge is, of some healthcare providers, some other members. Their argument is they can sue on this, correct me if I'm wrong, they can sue on this because there's the potential that in the future, if there's a side effect of someone taking mifepristone, one of their members as a healthcare provider might have to be involved with this, and that is the possible harm here. Could you talk about that standing argument?
Yeah, it's really strange one. Now, just the idea of standing, for every case in federal court, the person coming into court has to be personally injured. And they have to ask for something from the court that would fix the injury or at least compensate them for the injury. I can't go into court because you've been injured. You have to go into court. And so these doctors, they're anti-abortion doctors, and they said that because there are complications for people taking this drug, that they are forced to treat people who had procedures there or had wanted to have an abortion and they don't like abortion, or they have to complete the abortion, or there's just their practice is harmed because they have to take time away from other patients. It's a really strange claim for a bunch of reasons. One, this drug has some of the most minimal complication rates of any drug on the market. It's safer than Tylenol, Viagra, penicillin. So you would really open up any drug to be challenged because there's no perfect drug out there. Every drug has complications for some people. So you'd basically be opening up challenges to any drug. And second, I mean, if you go into emergency medicine, if you go into urgent care, this is what you do. You treat people who have complications from life, from medical procedures, from pills, from decisions that you don't agree with. That's just part of your job. And so doing something that's a normal part of your job doesn't seem like it should be enough to get you into federal court to claim that I am injured in a special way that means I can bring this lawsuit. So the standing issue was one of the many issues that made this case seem so strange.
Talking to David Cohen, professor at Drexel University's Law School, looking at the Supreme Court's stay on a ruling that would have blocked the mifepristone medication from being used all over the United States. But it's still not done. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Yeah, just listening to the conversation here. I think this was no surprise to see this passing of the buck, if you will, by the Supreme Court. They don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. I think that with the recent scrutiny of possible ethics violations of justices, this is the last thing they wanted to fall in their lap. Passing it back to the lower courts, forcing them to make a decision, just tries to kind of a delay tactic, if you will. Eventually, they're going to have to make a decision.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. David, Chris pointing us toward the future. Now, in the normal order of things, could the U.S. Supreme Court have weighed in on the merits of this case, or were they restricted to weighing in on this stay, which had been challenged?
For now, they were limited. I mean, look, they could have done anything. They could have decided we're going to take the case right now. And, you know, decide it in the next couple months. But what they did was they said, we're going to let this play out in the lower appeals court. So we have that initial order from the trial judge, Judge Kaczmarek. Now it's going to be appealed to the Fifth Circuit, the appeals court that covers Texas. That's going to happen. The oral argument for that's going to happen in mid-May. They will take however long they take to issue a decision. And then if either party's unhappy with that decision, they can appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court, which they likely will. Someone's going to be unhappy with that ruling. And the U.S. Supreme Court will probably jump in on this case, especially if the Fifth Circuit rules against the FDA. And upsets the status quo. I think we will see the Supreme Court get involved. But then even then, it won't be for another year and a half that we would get a decision, probably next June. And so the caller, I think there might be something to what the caller is saying, that the Supreme Court might want to just say, we're taking a little break from the abortion cases. They just overruled Roe v. Wade last summer. And so maybe wait another year before they get into it again. And issue another monumental decision around abortion. So I think the Supreme Court could again address this issue, but it will be a while.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And David, as I understand what the U.S. Supreme Court did, this stay now keeps mifepristone on the market, and it keeps it on the market even as the Court of Appeals hears it. Do I have that right?
Yes. So the Supreme Court said that mifepristone will remain approved through the Supreme Court's final decision in this case. Now, that could mean that the Supreme Court decides not to take the case. So, you know, the Supreme Court doesn't have to take every case that comes to it. So if the parties appeal whatever the Fifth Circuit does and the Supreme Court decides not to take the case, then the stay would end. Or the Supreme Court could take the case and the stay continues through their resolution of the case. So it really, you know, it really, the stay is in place. The status quo is in place until the Supreme Court next rules. Now, it's important to understand with what we're talking about here, just because mifepristone is on the market and approved doesn't mean it's available everywhere. Right. There are still 14 states, including Wisconsin, that has an abortion ban. And In those states, mifepristone would only be available for people who satisfy the exceptions to the abortion ban, which is a very small number of people, if any. So it's not available everywhere just because of the status quo ruling. It's only available when it's legal by state law.
And that's an important point. In a state like Wisconsin, with an existing 1849 law on the books, this case doesn't affect that existing state law in any way. Do I have that right?
Right. So states can still, at this point in time, states are still allowed to ban abortion. And just because the pill is approved by the FDA doesn't mean that states can't ban abortion generally. And that's what we have in Wisconsin and 13 other states right now. And so in those states, this ruling doesn't change the status quo that even before this case, abortion was illegal. Same with this case.
We're talking to Drexel University Law Professor David Cohen about the current and future legal status of the abortion medication mifepristone following a U.S. Supreme Court decision on Friday saying it stays on the market while a lower court hears a lawsuit against the FDA over their approval of the drug. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you surprised by the original ruling in this case or the Supreme Court's action on Friday? Why or why not? What kind of access do you think people should have to mifepristone? Do you have questions about the drug or the legal battle surrounding it? Do you find this all confusing? I promise, if so, you're not alone. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with David Cohen, professor at Drexel University's Law School and author of the book Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on the abortion medication mifepristone, what it means for the continuing legal fight over access to the drug. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the Supreme Court saying, yes, this drug used in abortions does stay on the market, at least for now? What questions do you have about the future or present of the lawsuit against the FDA over approval of this medication? Join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David, I want to talk a little bit about what's at stake. You've written about what people go through when they're seeking an abortion in the United States. Mifepristone, one of two drugs used in the United States. How important is medication abortion when it comes to abortion access? What do you see the potential impact if mifepristone were out of the equation?
At this point in time, the best data we have is that over half of the abortions in this country are done through medication. And that's a huge change over the past decade, decade and a half. And also in the past couple of years, abortion clinics have been allowed to mail pills to people. And so that means that people don't even have to go to a clinic to get an abortion. They can talk to a doctor or another medical care professional who's associated with an abortion clinic or a hospital, do all the counseling over the phone, and they can get their medical information, and then the pills can be mailed to them so they can have an abortion in the privacy of their own home. And people really seem to want that. I mean, just the numbers show that that is an appealing way for privacy reasons, but also for travel reasons. There are, you know, abortion clinics have been dwindling in this country for a long time. And so for a lot of people who live in states where there's a very small number of clinics, it takes a long time and a lot of resources to get to an abortion provider. And so because of abortion pills, people are able to get the pills by mail in states where it's legal and have an abortion in their home without having to travel. So what was at stake with this case was a method of abortion that is A, the most common, and B, really alleviates some of the problems with access that we've seen in this country with the closure of clinics, brick and mortar clinics, because people are able to get them by pills. And so that was the real threat here, that this was going after this common and accessible method of abortion. Now, it's not for everyone. A medication abortion is only up to about 10 or 11 weeks of pregnancy. And there are some complicating factors in people's medical histories that may not make them candidates for medication abortion. But for those for whom it works, it's a very accessible option.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Dale is with us in Mauston. Dale, hi.
Hi. Your guest had mentioned that mifepristone would be illegal in Wisconsin because of the state law we have regarding abortion. What if somebody wants to go out of state to get mifepristone? Are they affected? So I have kind of a general question. How is the Wisconsin law? Can that be enforced on somebody when they want to leave the border?
I gotcha, Dale. I don't know if you, the connection wasn't great there, David, but the idea of if you're just, you got it? Okay, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the interesting and complicated questions after Roe v. Wade was overturned. When we had a baseline that abortion was legal everywhere, we didn't have to think of the types of questions that the caller raised, but now we do. So think of people in Wisconsin, right? They can drive south to Illinois, they can drive west to Minnesota and get pills or have a procedural abortion. And I think most people think that as long as you're traveling into a state and following those states, that state's laws, that you don't have to worry about your home state's laws. And that's how I think the American justice system should work. Unfortunately, it's less than clear that that's actually the rules under constitutional law. We don't really have many cases raising the question of whether a state like, say, Wisconsin can penalize one of its residents for going out of state to do something that's illegal in Wisconsin but legal elsewhere. And I think we are going to see states try to do this. I don't know if it's going to be a Wisconsin prosecutor who's going to try to do this or another state or a legislature passing a law. We did see Idaho just a few weeks ago pass a law saying that it's illegal to drive a minor to get an abortion in other states. And so I think this is going to be one of the questions we have to confront in the coming years. And it really raises some deep questions about what it means to be a country with 50 different states and different rules within each state, but also a country where people think they, you know, believe they have the right to travel. And so I think your callers really identified an important question. Currently, there are a lot of people who do exactly what the caller asked about, who go to other states to get abortions, and that has not been challenged yet. But the anti-abortion groups know this, and it's on their radar.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to David Cohen from Drexel University's Law School, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court action on the abortion, or a drug often used in abortion, mifepristone. Now, David, a court of appeals prior to the Supreme Court ruling reached back to something called the Comstock Act from the 1870s. I'm seeing a lot of reporting on this. Have you been following this? Why is this popping up in this particular case?
The Comstock Act is something that a lot of people learned about in history classes because it was written in 1873. So it is literally 150 years old by an anti-vice crusader who didn't want people getting birth control, didn't want them getting anything considered obscene. And the law says that it's illegal. It's a federal law that says it's illegal to mail anything that's considered obscene, to mail birth control, or to mail anything that can cause an abortion. And this was a very successful law for about 50 years in the late 1800s, early 1900s. A lot of people went to jail, but there was a lot of backlash. And in the 1920s, 1930s, it fell out of favor and the courts started interpreting it much more narrowly. The thing is, it was never taken off the books. The birth control part was taken off the books. And the obscenity part was considered unconstitutional as a First Amendment issue. But the abortion part is still there, but it's been ignored for 100 years. Now the anti-abortion groups are saying, well, we've got this law in the books. It doesn't matter that it's from an era where women couldn't vote and didn't have representation. This law says it's illegal to mail anything that can cause an abortion. And so they are saying that abortion pills, which some people get through the mail, like I mentioned, shouldn't be allowed because people can mail them. But their argument really has no stopping point. It would also include banning any clinic from getting surgical supplies or medical instruments because those are through the mail or through FedEx or some comparable service. And so they're really pushing this argument as a way that they think to ban abortion nationwide, because if you can't send anything through the mail, that can cause an abortion, then all abortion will shut down in this country. So it is really a big part of the strategy right now to end abortion.
Samantha from Whitehall couldn't stay on the line, but reminds us that mifepristone is used for things other than abortion. She wonders what it would mean for people who use it for other purposes, like miscarriages and some other conditions that are treated with mifepristone. If this were ruled illegal, what about people who use it for purposes other than abortion, David?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really excellent question because it's a really important part of miscarriage management in particular. And the issue is that the only thing the FDA has approved mifepristone for is abortion. Miscarriage management and other uses related to obstetric care are off-label uses. And that's totally legal, totally fine. There's a lot of off-label uses for drugs of all sorts. The problem is if the one approval goes away, if the approval for abortion goes away, then that drug could disappear completely, in which case it would not be available for these other uses. So this is a big part of this case, which is that not only would it cut off abortion medication, abortion care, it could also cut off some other forms of important obstetrical care and make people really suffer.
And briefly, David, remind us the timeline of what to watch for next in this case.
The next thing we're going to see is oral argument in the Fifth Circuit in mid-May. They can decide any time after that. I imagine it'll be relatively quick, a month or two, but I think it'll be back to the Supreme Court in the fall with a decision next year.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's David S. Cohen, professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. He's author of the book Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. He was with us today for a look at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on the abortion medication mifepristone, keeping it on the market for now, overturning a lower court stay on the medication. And we looked ahead to where the legal battle is expected to go next. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some school districts in Wisconsin and elsewhere are having trouble finding teachers, especially in some high-demand subject areas. Find out how schools are working to solve the problem and join the conversation with what you're seeing in your own district. Whether you're a parent, a student, a teacher, or someone who hires teachers, join the conversation about at least some level of teacher shortages in Wisconsin and beyond. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk to an expert on curse words about why it seems like swearing is getting more common in the workplace and elsewhere. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with the answer to a Wisconsin question about polka.
We recently received a couple questions from listeners about Wisconsin's love affair with polka, like this one.
My name is Josie Dunn. I'm 10 years old, and I'm from Mineral Point, Wisconsin.
She asked,
how did the polka become a dance and a tradition?
And when I think about polka in Wisconsin, I think of one guy, second-generation Wisconsin and International Polka Association Hall of Famer, accordion wizard, and bandleader, Steve Meisner.
Hi, this is Steve Meisner, and I am a full-time musician living in Whitewater, Wisconsin, the land I love.
And here's Steve's quick answer.
Well, it started in Bohemia, and then the dance is invented, okay? And so that was spread throughout Europe as a dance, and it was in its day like rock and roll.
But Josie says she'd like to know a little bit more.
Because I know the polka is important to Wisconsin because it is the state dance, and I want to know a little more about it.
Steve?
It's woven into the fabric of our lives in this state. It's really in Wisconsin because of the rich European heritages that are in Wisconsin.
Okay. Like?
It spread from Bohemia through Poland, Czech Republic, Germany, Switzerland,
the Alps region.
The Dutchman style. The Polish style is completely different.
Whereas like the Slovenian style, or what I call the American Slovenian style that I do, is more melodic and has more of a swing feel.
Ah, okay. So, but what about the dance?
The Polish hop is the most prevalent in Wisconsin, which is part of the original that's from the old country. But like if you go to see Dutchman and Czech bands, you'll see more of the older folks doing like the two-step foxtrot, you know, sort of stepping
with the polka versus the raucous, you know, Polish hop style, which you'll get more with the Slovenian style and the Polish style.
But what's the learning curve on the whole dancing part?
Just let me just say that, you know, a lot of the people that want to learn that weren't raised with it, learned, you know. But for the average person, they just get out there and they just jump around. The greatest thing about polka music is it's forgiving. You know, like even my grandkids, I mean, they just love to get out. As soon as they hear the music, they just start getting a little bouncing going, you know, and they just want to get out there and do it.
So just how important do you think polka is to folks in Wisconsin?
It's very, very important to them. We have regular places that we play it all the time that are, you know, in certain areas like the Hiawatha Bar over in Sturtevant, and it's a part of their lives every month. If they miss a dance, they feel bad, you know. I've had generations of college students come out to Madison and say, "We came back for a reunion. Do you remember us from 10 years ago, you know? And we danced here all the time. We were here every time you played here." And I'm like, "Yeah, sure, I remember you guys."
So how does it feel being a Polka Hall of Famer from Wisconsin?
Yeah, it really is an honor because I'm hanging right there with my dad, of course, and Frankie Yankovic. And, you know, I mean, it's been a part of my life, my whole life, you know? So, I mean, truly, it's an honor.
And a little opening do for you right here in Pulaski, Wisconsin, with Steve and the boys. Thank you very much.
This story came from audience questions as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
Now, our broadcasting license from the FCC doesn't allow us to curse on the radio, and that's okay. But swearing is more acceptable in some workplaces than others. You might not want to swear at your boss, but it might be less of a big deal if you drop a profanity around a trusted coworker. Cursing has long been viewed as unprofessional or inappropriate, but it seems to have become more commonplace in other environments as our social and cultural norms change. Timothy Jay is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He's the author of 6 books on cursing, language, and inappropriate behavior. He's a widely cited expert on swearing. I talked to him earlier this year. Now, what is it? You've done a lot of work on swearing and cursing. What is it about swearing that, as a psychologist, you find so interesting?
Well, it's the speakable taboo. We're not supposed to do it, but everybody knows how to swear. And children know how to swear. So it's the one kind of language you learn very early on, but you're not allowed to use it. And I think it's the taboo nature of it. It's that, you know, that the edge of proper language, and you're like, where is that line? Where is it appropriate? What does it tell us about people and how they interact? How are cultures different? How does the brain mature to do this? There's so many questions that are interesting to me as a scientist that every time I found the answer to one question, a dozen more would pop up. That's why it's interesting to me.
Now, there's a handful of common words that might pop to mind when we think of cursing and swearing. What is it that leads a word to be promoted or demoted, however you want to think of it, to one of those words?
Well, it's all convention. These are all standards that have evolved over centuries, and they have mainly to do with religion, sexuality, relationships with ancestors, animal names, and sort of disgusting things that come out of your body. Those cover even globally, the categories of words that that become taboo. And the English-speaking countries, these words have been fairly stable for years. The four-letter words, these are 1,000 years old. So these are conventions or standards that are passed on from generation to generation, and they're policed by what I call the institutions of power, like religion, education, mass media all have standards. And the fact that these institutions of power punish people or reprimand people for using these language makes them remain powerful.
We're talking to Timothy J., psychologist expert on swearing and taboo language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the use of profane language. Do you see more of it than you used to? Where is it appropriate? Is it ever appropriate? What do you think? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to talk about context in which we use these words, Timothy. In my job on the radio, if I use certain words, I'm subjecting our station to potentially very big fines and me getting fired. If I use a profanity, say, at band practice, I might be, I don't know, building solidarity with the guys. Can you talk about the importance of context in determining when and where we say these words?
Yeah, that's the examples you gave are good. Context is the end all and the be all of using this kind of language. What a word means, how offensive it is, depends entirely on context, the who, what, where, and when. And as these variables shift, whether language is appropriate, offensive language is appropriate or not, it also shifts.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Morgan is with us in Eau Claire. Morgan, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for this. It really caught my attention just because I have a five-year-old and she loves to express herself. I will, you know, occasionally say, you know, the four-letter swear word, but like more like in excitement or just more to express myself. And I've noticed just as she gets older, she'll say it kind of just more casually than maybe some people would be comfortable with. So I guess just my question was, do you feel like that is something that is okay for her to be able to express? Or I guess I'm not sure what the line is between it being appropriate or being not appropriate.
Morgan, thanks. You're talking to a guy who wrote a book called What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty. What would you tell her, Timothy?
Yeah, every parent should anticipate this. By the time the kids go off to school, they probably have a vocabulary of about 40 different words that they've learned from their listening to their parents and to their friends. They might use these kind of words more with their friends than around their parents. But I think that's a great occasion for you, Meredith, to express your family values. And I think the best thing is to remain cool. You know, don't overreact. That only makes the words more powerful and gives the kids the, you know, I can push mom's buttons with these words. Remain cool. Ask them about their emotions. You know, like, why are you using this word? Are you angry? You know, you can also just say, I'm angry. But I think you want to keep the door open as a mother to talk about not only words, but also what's going to happen in a few years as the sexual terms will come in. And you don't want to be repressive about that. You know, you want to be, if you want to communicate your values about religion or sexuality, I think that's your role as a parent. So anticipate it, be cool about it. But if you have rules about this, then if the kid breaks the rule, then there are consequences. So I think it's an integral part of parenting. But what surprised me in the psychological literature, especially developmental psychology, there was no mention of this in the in scientific literature. That's why one of the reasons why I wrote the book, What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty, is every parent knows this is important. And also, besides the four-letter words, it's like, how do I talk about my body? How do I talk about the things that come out of my body? You know, how does my family talk about these things? So take that as a as a role as a parent and as an educator to teach values to your daughter.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to psychologist Timothy Jay with the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts about cursing and the cultural norms around naughty words. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about swearing? Do you think people should let loose and say what they want? When, where, what environment is the right time to swear, if any? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, hear from some more of you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Timothy Jay, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of many books on the subject of cursing and swearing. He's with us today to talk about why we swear, how different social environments affect the language we use. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in the Beloit area. Bob, hello.
Why, hello. So I just wanted to bring this up. My mom is going to be 101 in March, still living at home, and she started a cussing club probably when she was in her 80s. And her theory behind it was to bring all the friends and people over. They could come in, they could cuss, they could get everything out of their system. And she kind of thought that people, when they got older with dementia, then wouldn't be doing that as much because they felt free to get that out at this point. I just thought that was a interesting vision, and there's no scientific evidence behind it, obviously, but I'm curious about what your speaker's thoughts are on that.
Well, and Bob, I gotta ask, have you been to one of these, or were you not invited as you know, a kid, not
no,
one
I
of
was,
the peers?
I was not invited. This was something my mom did with a bunch of her lady friends, and primarily started because one of her friends was getting dementia and was starting to cuss and use some languages. And this made her feel more comfortable, bringing her in and doing social functions when everybody could come in and just
Bob,
have at it.
That is super interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Timothy, I'm gonna guess there may not be a lot of research on this, but what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think it's also part of what we're seeing now, more women swearing generally as more women are in the workplace, more women in public. Sort of a more empowerment of women to use this, what I would call powerful language. Certainly, if you're going to work in a high pressure context like a law firm, the women in the law firm are going to pick this up. But with regard to aging, although I can never imagine my mother doing this, I was raised in a very religious family. I never heard my mother swear, although my father was a bricklayer, and I heard him swear, especially at work. But we have studied cursing in nursing homes, and what he reported is happening. What is happening is there in a nursing home, you have sort of with dementia, you have a reversion to childhood, and the people with dementia become very childlike. They're not as careful about their bath habits, and they revert to the emotional language of childhood. If the person is bilingual, they usually will revert to swearing in their native language. But this is common in nursing home settings, especially in the dementia wings. And where you will see them using the language of their childhood. So what we recorded about 20 years ago in the nursing homes was we didn't have the offensive language that teenagers use now. It was mainly profanity, words like Jesus, damn, goddamn, words like that. It will be interesting to see when the younger generation reaches the nursing home and has dementia, I would imagine the kind of language we'll hear in another 40 or 50 years is going to be a lot worse now. But the use of profanity during dementia is common along with other sort of childlike behavior.
Bob, thanks for sharing that story. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I'm under the impression that for a lot of swear words covering taboo subjects, that the culture, whatever the culture it is that's using those words, they tend to borrow the words from other cultures. Somehow, for one's own culture, it's demeaning to use words to cover perhaps sexual subjects, and so you borrow words from other cultures.
Tom, interesting. Thanks. Timothy, is that something that we happen? We use loan words for some of these ideas?
Well, I think of the lexicon of swearing like a garden, and there are some plants in there that are ancient, and like the F word and the S word, those words have been around for 1,000. They grew up in Anglo-Saxon culture, but also influenced by German and Italian. So there is some borrowing. Where I see that obviously today is the expansion of hip hop culture around the world globally, where you have people that are saying American swear words that they pick up in hip hop from music and other genres of hip hop. And they, you know, it's common to hear this in Sweden or Germany or Switzerland, to hear swear words being appropriated. This is happening now more than ever because of the global expansion of entertainment media and film and music, but also the internet.
Tom, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Interesting point. Talking to Timothy J., psychologist, expert on swearing. Back to your calls. Adam was with us in River Falls. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Yeah, interesting topic. Growing up on a farm, there was lots of cursing down in the barn when things did not go well, but my mom made sure we did not use those words in the house. So my question is, how much control do we have over these words? And as I'm raising little boys now, and you mentioned kids earlier on, are there any tactics in helping make sure that those words don't come up or aren't used as much as they can be?
Well, I think on that last note, I think you should expect them to come up. Every competent speaker of English knows all these swear words. I think what you need to engage them is in a discussion of etiquette. Language has styles, like clothing has styles, and where you learn where it's appropriate and where it's not appropriate. I had the same kind of division of labor in my house where what happened at work was different than what happened at the dinner table. And I think by the time boys are adolescents, they need to learn that what you can say in the backyard, what you can say in the barn is different than what you can say at work or at school. That's just part of, you know, learning your culture. And I think sometimes, like when things go wrong anywhere in the barn or on the golf course or at work, and we become frustrated, it seemed to be there's sort of a natural reflexive use of this, like the hammer on the thumb idea. So that kind of stuff, I think, is a habit which is kind of drilled into you or that you've practiced enough that it becomes almost automatic. Whereas other times, I think answering the question about control is a matter of, should I use this kind of language or tell this kind of joke in this situation? And there's where it's not like the hammer on the thumb. It's more like what I call strategic use of this. Like, that's not a good idea to say that here. Or maybe I should say that here because I'm angry.
Adam, thanks for that call. And Timothy, thanks again for joining us today.
As I said, I'm darn glad to be here and tell your listeners to support public radio. I do.
That was Timothy J., Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. I talked to him about why it's getting more appropriate to swear over time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, how can we get really good at a new skill? We'll get advice from the author of the new book, The Real Work, on the mystery of mastery. And the host of the comedy podcast and TV series Comedy Bang Bang has a new book out. We'll get a sneak preview with Scott Aukerman. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.